I think I'll make you work a little in defining what a mandala is. I'll give you one clue. A mandala is a circle, but what is it? Why is it so important? What kind of a circle is it? What is it? A circle that can be painted, that could be, what else?
Stained glass, rose
windows, exactly. Could even be danced. And I'd like to have you visualize our worship center in the village center. There are four candles and the altar. And when we came for communion on Sunday, we all stood around in a circle. So we formed a living mandala in the worship center. Now, the mandala is, I'll give you the definition, a symbol of wholeness. And that's why it's so important.
Mandala.
Yeah. It is a Sanskrit word, and it's taken over, but Jung used it as a symbol of wholeness.
That's the Sanskrit word. From the Sanskrit.
And you will see it many, many places. On the board, I drew for you one that Luther used, and this is the Lutheran symbol, which you will find right here on the front of Dan Erlander's book, which I highly recommend, too. You see here the two circles, and then five divisions, a heart and a cross. Many mandalas have a cross in the center. For those who come late, I will write what this is. It's the Lutheran symbol. So that is a mandala as well. And this one over on this side is Jung's first mandala. He sketched every day. And this is the one he did in 1916. I will explain it as we go along. Just take it in and look at it, you'll see all the various components in there. Last week we talked about symbols of the self, or symbols of dreams. One of the symbols, I said, was of the self. And the self is whole in the sense that it is striving towards wholeness and integration. And it is not just your conscious self, it's not just your ego, it's not just the way you appear to other people, it's all aspects of yourself, the dark side and the light side, the acceptable and the unacceptable, the conscious, the unconscious, the totality. So when we talk of wholeness, we talk of the entirety of the healthy, of that which is not partial, which is perfect. Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, even including the dark side. And the mandala is a symbol of this wholeness or of the self. I would like to read to you how Jung himself wrote it, and it will give you an idea of why it is so important. And why I spent this whole hour now on mandalas, because each one of you is carrying within yourself many different symbols of wholeness, your own individual mandala, which may come to you in a dream, it may come to you in a semi-conscious state, or it may be consciously done in the morning when you try to put down not just your dreams, but some symbol of what it all stands for. In his book, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, which is also in the bookstore, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections is Jung's autobiography, his inner development. He tells how he painted his first mandala in 1916. Now let's see, he was born in 1875. How old would that make him?
41.
Yeah, about 41. He lived to be 84, so he had a long life ahead. I sketched, now this is a quote, Jung, Carl Jung himself. Carl Jung is a Swiss psychiatrist, for those who haven't been here before, who is the pioneer in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, on a par with Freud, but going in a different direction, branching out more to mythology and stressing the importance of dreams, of archetypal symbols, and forward-looking rather than backward-looking. In another session, I will talk about his work. Now I am quoting from Carl Jung, as he wrote in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections about mandalas, which we defined as symbols of wholeness. Quote, I sketched every morning in a notebook a small circular drawing, a mandala, which seemed to correspond to my inner situation at the time. With the help of these drawings, I could observe my own transformations from day to day. Gradually, I found that it also was a cryptogram, a shorthand, in which I saw the self, my whole being, actively at work. To be sure, at first I could only dimly understand them, but they seemed to me highly significant, and I guarded them like precious pearls. As an aside, these mandala drawings, and he was no artist. He doesn't expect us to be artists. These mandala drawings are in a red leather-covered book, and they are reproduced in some of his collected works. As he said, he guarded them like precious pearls. I had the distinct feeling that they were something central, and I began to acquire a living conception of the self. It corresponded to a microscopic nature of the psyche. And when I'll show you the rose windows, they are like macroscopic pictures of the universe. And you know, the universe and the psyche follow pretty much the same laws. In fact, that's the amazing, wonderful thing. Jung's discovery of the mandala provided the key to his entire system of psychology. Now I quote again. I had to let myself be carried along by the current without notion of where it would lead me. This is a great trust. You see, you cannot consciously do this. You have to permit yourself to be carried along. When I began drawing mandalas, Jung said, I saw everything, that all the paths I had been following were leading back to a central point. It became increasingly plain to me that the mandala was the center. It is the path to the center. It is the path of individuation, which I talked about before. During those years, after 1916 to 1920, I began to understand that the goal of psychic development is the self. There is no linear path, but a spiral path. Those who were here before have seen me heard me talk about the spiral path of development, that we have to go over and over, but hopefully in a spiral upward, so that we gather wisdom as we go along. This, quote, this insight gave me stability, and my inner peace was returned. In his collected works, he says about mandalas, they usually appear in situations of great confusion and perplexity. There is a pattern of order, like a psychological viewfinder, in which a marked cross or circle divided into four is superimposed on the psychic chaos, so that the content falls into place and the confusion is held together by the protective circle. Now look at the mandala again. Let's look at the Lutheran symbol. You see the protective circle? You see the cross holding it together, the cross in the heart. And you see here, the protective circle. And a lot of other symbols, including the spiral down there. That was his very first one. There are not necessarily all symmetrical, though most of the time they are. I'd like to repeat this concept of the viewfinder, that the mandala symbol is like a viewfinder that brings order, that constellates order over chaos in your psyche. And as you draw these drawings, they are aids to your own meditation. They help you bring things together, and they are like a protective or ordering symbol of the psyche, and they represent the stage of order that you are at inside yourself. Now, when he found that mandalas were so prevalent, not only in art and like in rose windows and in mythology, in his own patient's drawings and his own drawings, he began to study them more extensively and studied American Indian sand paintings, and found there too a great prevalence. If you look at Indian art, you will see how these symmetrical drawings are used over and over again. Many primitive tribes use these or have art that embodies mandalas, because they are universal symbols. Each culture has their own. So far, how are we doing? Does mandala make a little more sense now? So mandala is a symbol of wholeness, a symbol of the self. Yeah.
Now you're saying he drew these out of a creativity kind of thing, not out of a consciousness sort of thing.
Yes, and yes. Okay. And he allowed them to arise more or less spontaneously. But my daughter likes to doodle, and she draws on graph paper. She does it quite consciously, and what comes out is also a mandala. If you make a symmetrical drawing, I should have had this more ready, but I'll find it in a minute. Anyhow, have you ever drawn anything real symmetrical and started with one circle and then a square and then a triangle and then another square, and you know, and isn't it satisfying to draw something like that? And you don't know where it really comes from, do you? Well, I shall find them later. I can't find them right now. I need to go on to the rose windows, because you've all seen and heard of these beautiful stained glass windows, and I came across this book, which I brought along to share with you. It has magnificent pictures, and later some of you can come and look at them. And I did not realize until I really started studying it how much theology and even mathematics was included, depicted. But there is almost a whole theology depicted in each of the windows. Sometimes Mary and sometimes Christ is in the middle. And the whole New and Old Testament in various forms is depicted around them. They are to do what in our worship? Yes, to bring all the symbols together to give us the beauty and the order that is in creation, to make it visual for us. And when the light comes through these rose windows, the ordinary white sunlight, which is beautiful enough in itself, is broken up into this absolute splendor. And you sort of feel hushed. I personally need a visual symbol. I love to be in a cathedral with rose windows or stained glass windows. It doesn't have to be Chartres, of course. And I love incense and candles and all the symbols. But many of you may prefer to worship in places that are simpler, because after all, what we're dealing with is an inner thing. However, we will not solve this difference now. Each person has a way of worshiping that is most congenial to them. How do Lutherans go about it? Do you have a lot of incense? No?
No.
No incense.
Or stained glass windows?
We have
stained glass windows.
Uh-huh.
Hot coffee.
What?
Hot coffee.
Hot coffee. Well, it's not as stark as Southern Baptist, that's for sure. And I have also been at Quaker worship where we sit in total silence. And that is a tremendous experience. That is, you see, at the other end where you go into your inner self and you sit in silence and let the word arise, and whatever someone speaks is then thought about, meditated on, and maybe the next person will speak half an hour later on the same or similar topic. Maybe this week we will have a silent worship session, or next week, I believe. Well, back to the beautiful rose windows. We've come a long ways from rose windows. In Chartres, I should write that on the board, Chartres Cathedral in France, which is the most famous? There is a window which I would like to describe to you, and then I will pass it around and you can look at it in greater detail.
Everybody should be up here, it's great.
Yeah. Well, I'll just show it to you from here. I'm going to be talking about this one here. It has Mary in the middle, and I will describe it to you, and then I'll pass it around, okay? Okay. It's called Rose of France, and it's the north window. In the middle, it is entirely dedicated to the Virgin Mary, who is at the center, surrounded by doves. Then in the next hierarchy are 12 squares depicting the kings of her ancestry, as Matthew describes them, going back to David. So each of these squares has another king depicted. Beyond that are the 12 prophets of the Old Testament. Then in between there are little fleur-de-lis, the symbol of the Virgin Mary and of royalty. And on the outside are semicircles with the, oh, those, that's where the prophets are, sorry, in the semicircles around are the prophets. What is fascinating about this window is that it is built up by a geometry that is described in the back that just blew my mind or boggled my imagination, because it is based on the growth curve of flowers, and flowers in nature, I mean flowers, plants, or any growth, and I've mentioned this before, grow in a certain spiral way, and this method is mathematically worked out to be the sum of each preceding number. It forms a perfect spiral when you do it. 1 and 2 is 3. 3 and 2 is 5. 5 and 3 is 8, and so forth.
Is that 5 or 2 or 7? Is that golden
numbers? No, it's called Fibonacci numbers. Let's see. It also is the golden section, you're right, yeah. And I was amazed when I read that. And here in the back you will see how the spiral can be superimposed on this window. I don't want to get too technical though, just suffice that this also embodies the perfection of growth in nature. So geometry and growth, perfection, and the order of the universe, the order behind creation is depicted in these windows. In another window, Christ is seated in the middle, and surrounded again by prophets of the Old Testament and by pictures of his passion and of his glory and ascension and glory. The universe is manifested in every form in a rose window, the concentric layers of which echo the spheres containing the sun, the moon, the planets, and the stars. In a west window at Notre Dame in Paris, the spheres contain the zodiac, time portrayed as the months of the year, the vices and virtues, the prophets, all surrounding the Virgin Mary. She is a symbol and the culmination of the evolving universe, which becomes known in the present in the perfected labor of the months. Well, we're getting very mystical there. But you see how fantastic these symbols are and how these windows are depict for us the history and the beauty of the and the order and the beauty of the universe. I would like to go back to the symbols as they appear inside and within ourselves. I wanted to point you to the rose windows to say, show you that they're not just something out there, but that they reflect what we read about in the Bible and what Jung maintains is also the microcosm of the psyche, that it is a similar order and a similar perfection is within us if we, as we grow. We go through stages of chaos, we go through stages of integration and wholeness, and more we integrate towards higher and higher degrees of wholeness. But we never get there. Change continues. And that's why we need these aids to worship us, to remind us of the wholeness, you see? When we're falling apart and you look at one of these glorious windows or you see a mandala, you suddenly are reminded again that everything fits together in the universe. And that is why they are aids to your worship and to your meditation. Okay, I've said many things. Maybe I need a few questions to for some.
In the Native American culture, they've got the medicine wheel.
Yeah.
And that's really a beautiful, I don't know, if that, I never thought of the mandala, mm-hmm. that their orientation to the universe.
Yes, as I said, the American Indians, their sand paintings are all mandalas. In the book, Man and His Symbols, there are quite a few pictures of sand paintings. And I didn't bring it along. In the other book as well, he talks about African culture and how they rely on it, and also how the medicine men have dreams that are almost perfect mandalas, you see. Now, usually it has, what, a circle and a cross, a fourfold division, and another square, and another circle, and they just go on indefinitely. In one of my earlier talks, I drew one on the board, one that I did myself that came to me one time. Let's see, what can I take off here? I did this, the symbol of eternity, infinity rather, this way. The symbol of infinity this way. And then held together by the cross in the middle, and then circle around it, various portions. It's very poorly drawn. It's the cross that holds the opposites together, and I think we talked about the universal symbolism of the cross, and that when we worship, we bring to it our understanding of the gospel, and we can get power from the symbol because it's like a shorthand. Remember, Jung said a mandala or one of those symbols is a shorthand for all these many things that we know about it. And what we bring to it helps us get the power back. And it should always be a dialogue. We come with our reading of the week, with our prayers, with our understanding of the Bible and our provocative, living word that we have studied in the morning with John Schramm, and we come to Vespers, and we see the inscription, we have this treasure, where?
In earthen vessels.
All right, and it suddenly has a new meaning. Suddenly, treasure, priceless pearl comes to mind. And it speaks to us in a new way.
Yeah. Can you go into any more detail about the impact that the mandalas had on Jung? You told us they were very important to his developing self. Mm-hmm. But can you be more specific about that?
Okay, he... in this book, he published... all right, let's start again. For himself, the impact was that he could see his own growth and development day by day, and could understand, since he was getting more and more familiar with it, he could tell if he was at a higher stage, if he had integrated more or less. It helped him for his own centering. He had all of his patients draw mandalas for themselves, and then he saw how some of them played back the same universal symbols that he had been talking about consciously. So he saw that this was really true of the unconscious, which carries in it the archetypal symbols. So he used it practically as a practical device in his therapy. And I think he also used it as an aid for his own meditation and prayer.
Do you have any anecdotes?
No, I really don't have anecdotes, but I have at home a picture of his study, and on his wall there are mandalas. You see, it's the kind of thing like you put your favorite painting on the wall, and he had a picture of the Chartres rose window on the wall, for example, and some of his own, and then he did his own in this leather-covered book, which has not totally yet been reproduced, only a few, you see. Okay, I'm sorry, I don't have an anecdote.
I'm just kind of curious about this circle of a hearth that we all love so much here.
Ah.
It would be different, wouldn't it, if it were square or triangular?
Mm-hmm.
Like
it's unique,
circle.
Is it not? I like it so much. Well, when we sit in a circle, we often have a circle dances. The other night, were you all here? Circle dances are a way of acting out. They occur on many levels. The stained glass is the highest, and this little symbol down there is probably the lowest. And Jung's first sketch is pretty primitive. The Lutheran symbol is probably right there in the middle. It says an awful lot. Let's look at it again. What can you see in it? What is the center? The cross where?
Mm-hmm.
In the heart. So the theology of the cross in the heart, standing for God's love. And what would you make of that? Those little marks? I mean, we're just practicing a little analysis here. This could be the power of the spirit, perhaps?
Radiating.
But lest it get too far out of hand, because that power is power. You have the protective circle on the outside. Yeah, you see, I think John mentioned this morning, if you don't have any form or any containment, this can pull you apart.
Well, I have a second circle.
Well, maybe a double circle is better than the single one. He also said we could color it in. Let's see what the colors are in this. Yeah, I think.
Why should you hold the spirit in?
Well, that's a good question. Why should you hold the spirit in? Because we are frail earthen vessels, precisely. And we could be shattered or pulled apart by that power.
Well, this is not the Holy Spirit.
Well, I don't see why it wouldn't be.
Well, then you don't hold the Holy Spirit.
Well, that's a good point. You don't hold the Holy Spirit. Well, anyone else want to talk to this?
It seems to me that in your own earthen frame, you can contain only so much of this power. And in relating to the world, it seems to me important to have a protective.
Well, that doesn't mean that the Holy Spirit is reckless.
not really, but I'll have to think about that.
Isn't that outer circle representative of eternity in Luther's symbol? And,
perhaps.
And there's nothing outside that power.
Oh, all right, that's good. Thank you. Yeah.
There's a quote from what this man said in the colors, too. Gold is the dominant color on the outside, which is in traditional Catholic Christian tradition, heaven.
Yes.
And in the great paintings of the Annunciation, gold, the angel is surrounded with gold. Mary, always Mary, wears a mantle of blue, and blue is the next dominant color in that. And Luther's seal, is that what you're dealing with?
Yeah, Luther's seal.
And
yes.
Mary being a mortal woman, and heaven joined to give Jesus, who is perfect man and perfect God. So blue and gold are ancient Catholic traditions of blue, earth, and Mary, and gold, heaven, and God.
Thank you. According to this, this is a gold border. Heaven, a blue field, a white rose. This represents a rose. I didn't draw it too well. This would be indented. A red heart and a black cross.
Yeah. So that may explain that somewhat. If you just now, after this talk, walk around and look, you will notice an awful lot of new symbols and. In church architecture, I think they're prevalent. And I took the most beautiful cathedral as an example, but even in simpler churches, you'll find them, and on the altar and so forth. Any other questions or criticism?
Where do we go from here?
Now, how does this relate to our dreams, for example? We've talked a lot about mandalas, we've talked about dream symbols. Some of you have had dreams, and they're very ordinary kinds of things, you know. But if you come across a strong visual image in your dream and you draw it, you might suddenly see that it falls together in the mandala. You could draw one aspect of the dream and see how it works out. It's all to help you understand yourself better. It's very important to remember that you can't learn anything in one day or one hour, and that it all takes time, and also how much you put in, just as I mentioned in the worship, how much you bring to the symbol, so much you will get back. And Christ or the Holy Spirit speaks to us through the unconscious, the collective unconscious, through dreams, and it is very important that we try to be in touch with that if we want to understand ourselves better. Earlier I had read to you how he said that he had been swimming against the stream, and I'll come back to that. I had to let myself be carried along by the current without a notion of where it would lead me. And I think we think that's scary, to sort of give up conscious control. But you have to listen to your dreams and let yourself be carried by them. And in therapy, I often have to talk a long time with the clients to tell them to let go of this tight control which they try to have over their life, because we have not that tight control. You have to be willing to let go, to let yourself be carried, like on a stream. And that's why I said, when you dream of floating or riding on the waters, that's a symbol of this being carried by the current.
I myself had a dream back in graduate school when I was pushing awfully hard. I was always swimming against the stream. It was great, great effort. And one time, after a while, I dreamt of just letting go and going with the current. And very shortly thereafter, my whole life took a different turn. I didn't pursue the PhD, but I plunged into marriage and motherhood instead, and found it very pleasant, floating, swimming. There we go. Yeah. Anyhow, it was a turnaround, and it was going with the stream. My unconscious is telling me, don't push so hard for this high achievement, but do that which nature has destined you for. So. It's a bit dramatic, but it really happened. So. And so I would urge you all to think about where you need to let go, in what areas of your life, and to trust that you can be carried along by the current of your unconscious. Questions?
Is it true that you can't learn anything instantly?
Very true.
I wonder. I doubt it.
Well, you can have insight, of course. Aha! You can suddenly see everything fall into place or a problem be resolved very instantly. But I'm talking about growth and development, and that really does take a lot of time. You know? Did you have anything specific in mind?
Well, I was thinking of a baby, a newborn baby.
That is an instinct, I think, that he's born with. Yeah.
You might have an instinct. When you hit something, you know it instantly.
Yeah.
Has been applied to Mozart, for instance, in his music. These geniuses.
Yeah, the geniuses, yeah. Well, they're so far above us. Thank you, yeah?
The speaking of genius, the two of the funniest things that ever happened in dreams, and the most delightful, not to me, but in history, was the Elias Howe and the sewing machine.
Yeah.
There is no story that I love to tell more than that one. The short version is that he could not invent the sewing machine because he was so traditionally thought that the needle has the eye at one end and the point at the other. In the dream, he saw a snake where the eye of the snake moved from the head of the snake to the tail, and back and forth and back and forth. Finally, the eye of the snake came to rest in the tail. He said, aha, I will make a needle that is different from any that has ever been made before, where the point and the eye and the needle are in the same location. And then the sewing machine, which many of you know, has two spools of thread, whatever you call it, one at the top, one at the bottom. With that idea that came in the dream, which was, well, here is the catch. The dream quickly gave him the idea, but he thought about it for years. And the other is even more fun to talk about. That's the man who could not figure out the structure of benzene. And he saw the benzene ring in the dream. If you and I saw the benzene ring, that would be a new pattern for crochet. But with him, it had great vitality, and he did it.
Very pertinent. Thank you. That's how geniuses can learn and find answers in their dreams. Anyone else?
The benzene ring could have been a month.
Yeah, very, that's true.
I don't know whether he saw them as six snakes head pinching tail or not. I would be lying if I said he saw it that way.
Some of us are kind of dumb. What's a benzene ring?
Well, draw a benzene ring.
I can't.
What's it excited?
Well, explain what it's used for. I mean, chemically. You're a chemistry major.
It's just like a hexagon shaped molecule.
Six-sided.
Uh-huh. It's just six-sided. Yeah.
Are you a chemistry major? Yeah. Ah. Well, help us a little more. I really don't know that much about chemistry either.
I don't know, there's not that much you can
tell. It's just that he saw how the molecules were attached.
Yeah, he knew there were six carbons and there were 12 hydrogens, and he, you know, all the ways he tried to put them together, he couldn't get that to work. And then one day he kind of fell asleep, and in his dream, he saw them all come together as a ring. And then he knew what it was. He realized that was the structure.
Yes. So there's a practical application of it. And what do we use benzene for? Is it cleaning fluid? And is also
I don't think you use benzene as a cleaning fluid because it is carcinogenic.
Oh.
We don't use it in the lab very much.
Mm-hmm.
But they use it for synthesizing things.
And it's very important.
Yeah.
That's good. Yes?
That the recognition of the benzene ring was the beginning of our entire new era of chemistry, the aromatic chemistry.
Ah, yeah. So it's even more important. So I always thought of it as an illustration of how people solve problems in dreams and how important dreams were. Now I see that it also has an outer practical importance. Just as I thought a mandala only has an inner thing, and I saw it in the rose windows, you see. So everything seems to hang together, work together. Yeah? Yes?
Aren't there many authors who say that they're trying to resolve a plot or something and they can't do it, and so go to bed sleep on it, and then their subconscious somehow solves it for them in the morning, and they're,
I do see, yes, I think so. I think that when you're working on something very much and you're very involved with it, and then you get tired, you really haven't been able to resolve it, and you're thinking about it, it's not much good to keep working till 1 and 2 and 3 in the morning. It's better to go to sleep and let it integrate in your during your sleep. Did that help you when you were writing your book? Did you sleep on it?
Oh, absolutely. Firmly trust if you've got a problem that as soon as you wake up in the morning you remember it, just to say yes, that's
mm-hmm.
That you haven't had time to wave back and forth because you could get paralyzed.
That's right.
Back and forth and back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Very much.
Yeah.
That sounds very much like Rollo May's theory of creativity, how, you know, like he was saying, you know, you say you created something in 5 minutes, you know, you've been thinking about it 5 years, but it just came.
Mm-hmm.
That idea of needing to get away from something, let your mind just process it so you can go on to the next level.
Yeah. Processing has been very important for me at Holden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After our experience.
What
was that?
My rocks.
Oh.
You want your rocks?
Are you throwing rocks? But back to your point. Back to your point about the artist could suddenly see, or the artist or the scientist suddenly sees the solution. All creativity demands a period of incubation in which the work is done. And then the resolution, and that happens very fast. That time span is awfully long, but varies. And writers often complain they're stuck. They can't find the solution. They can't bring things together. And then it all falls together, and they can do it.
Well, for Jim's benefit, we can,
that's
the Baptist principle, there's submersion, and then for a long time, and then there's instant immersion. I mean, immersion, and then submersion, right?
Yeah.
Jim's a Baptist.
And similarly, a similar process occurs in therapy. There is the statement of the problem. The person comes in, the first statement, the first dream, and the first sessions are, you know, electric and full of things happening. And then there's a long period of seemingly nothing happens. It's at that point that they say, yeah, I'm wasting my money, and I'm coming here. It's just terrible. And then suddenly, and we never know when, it's just almost miraculous. Suddenly what they couldn't do before, they can do. They solve all their problems, or most of them, and it happens very fast. And at that point, then I'll say, well, come back for a checkup in 6 weeks or 6 months, you know, whatever. And so you have to trust your intuition. It's really fascinating. And each person has their individual pace going through.
Would you say that dreams would have an incubation period?
Dreams? No, not the dream itself. The process of becoming, of getting well, or the process of creating something new has takes a period which we call incubation period. It's a slow going, fitting together of all the parts.
Now, when you're thinking about something, what about those who say that doodling is an indication of it? You can almost predict, you know, how it's going to come out by the basis of the doodles.
Somebody, and I don't know who, looked at his doodles and found a lot of clues to what he was thinking.
They found Stalin's doodles at one of the famous summit conferences during World War II.
Oh.
And everything was boxed in. And they decided he was very insecure. I mean, everything had a box around it. And I don't know.
That's fascinating.
Do would psychologists use something like doodles?
I think if a person comes in very disturbed, his doodles would probably, anybody's doodles would reveal, because you're not consciously leading them. You're not consciously doing them. But I know of a study of doodles. I have to look it up.
There is one famous study of doodles, and Nijinsky, the great dancer who became schizophrenic and finally incapacitated. Something like the character in Dostoevsky, who knew when his epilepsy was coming on.
Yeah.
Nijinsky knew when a schizophrenic break was coming. He would doodle with the opening dance step. And the psychiatrist who studied him said he was yearning to hold on to his reality, to his profession, to his dance steps. He would doodle endlessly, visualizing the dance steps, the opening ballet steps, to try to hold back the chaos of his madness.
Fantastic. And really.
And again, I come to the quote that I have. The mandalas appear in psychic confusion, and when you draw a circle, divide it in four, and draw the symmetrical thing, it helps you keep the confusion together, especially at times of great stress. But they're very comforting, just the act of doing it, even if you do it quite consciously. That's the paradox. And paradox is something that I'm going to talk about some more tomorrow, as well as the opposites, the law of opposites. That's all fundamental. Nothing ever remains the same. Everything changes. And yet, the change is the thing that remains the same. You see what I mean? But paradox is the law of living, really. Certainly of psychic development. So tomorrow I would like to talk more about type. That will be much more bread and butter type things than what I've been talking about today. Everybody falls into either extroversion, introversion, or other specific types, and there's no value judgment on it. It's just the way you are. And
what about the yin and the yang symbol? That comes in that same.
Yes, that fits very much into the same thing. I would say the yin and yang is a mandala. Thank you. Next time I'm going to include that. I should have put it on the board. Do you all know what the yin and yang looks like?
That lower circle towards you.
What?
That lower, is that a doodling circle?
Yes.
Yeah?
No, that's a spiral.
It's a spiral.
Yeah. Well, let's take this one off here now. I never quite know how it is. First of all, it's a circle. And then it's divided this way. Ah! And there, this is all dark.
One's feminine, one's masculine.
Yeah. This is all dark and has a light spot. This is all light and has a dark spot. Isn't that? Wait, look.
No, it must be. It
more
must,
of an S.
It must be done with an S shape.
Yeah. All right, do it with an S shape.
You think of the Safeway store.
Right.
The Safeway store is.
I don't know what the Safeway store looks like.
Yes.
Not the Pacific Railroad.
Right, Pacific Railroad.
Yes.
Well,
much better.
You all know it. Yeah. Well, you helped me with getting some things I hadn't even thought about. I know the yin yang is, of course, the universal light and dark, the night and day, the constant change from one state to another, and that it always will revolve and always return. And that in the darkness there's light, and in the lightness there's some darkness.